with habitats that range from wetlands to prairies to forests to savannas, it's no wonder that here in Wisconsin we enjoy such a rich diversity of wildlife. And we can all be proud that it's really part of our culture to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in the different seasons. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. I always enjoy when wildlife ecologist Scott Craven comes by for his monthly visit, and I know you do too. He's always happy to share what he's been seeing and to help us understand what's been going on out there. Great to have you with us, as always, Scott.
It's good to be here. It's great to be able to bring my trained eyes and ears to bear on the subject, even though they don't seem to work as well as they did 20 or 30 years ago.
I have to say they're still better than a lot of ours, including mine, which are somewhat younger than yours, but but no, it's always great. You always kind of know exactly what to zero in on, and I know we all appreciate it. So, of course, it doesn't take very trained eyes and ears to notice that we've had a really cool wet spring so far.
Well, that's certainly true, and it wouldn't seem quite as bizarre, except it's compared immediately to last year when summer started in March, and it is just really strange. Just around my own property, it's been so wet, I still haven't been able to spray my apple trees and do a few basic maintenance activities that normally would have been done a month or two ago, and the garden plants, my gosh, I've been gone, as you know, for 3 weeks on the road in northern Wisconsin teaching, and holy mackerel, my peppers and tomatoes that I had to rush to get in looked like I just took them out of the six-pack after 3 weeks of no growth. Growth in quotes. So, yeah, it's been strange for gardening. It's been strange for outdoor activity. The water was still brutally cold up in northern Wisconsin, but there is a lot of water. The ditches are still full. A lot of lakes that have been low for a long time are returning to normal. Some are even extremely high. And for some things, like amphibians, if you're a frog, it's or a salamander, it's fat city
you're
up
you're
there.
In frog heaven.
You're in frog heaven. There were still lots of singing frogs when some of the early ones should have dropped out of the chorus by now. Our students who were out and about studying amphibians, among other things, were finding lots of egg masses and tadpoles and adults, frogs and amphibians all over the place, which is good news because amphibians are still suffering in a broad sense. So,
well, and last year, again, comparing it to, you know, I don't think any of us even remember what normal is anymore because this year is unusually cool and wet. Last year was unbearably beastly hot and dry, you know, so I'm thinking that's especially good news that the amphibians are doing so well this year because you would think that drought last year was really a stress on them.
They took a beating last year, and so now it's good. Everything comes and goes, and over the long haul, things survive, but it had some impacts on other things that people were interested in. The morels, for example, were very late. The turkey season took a bit of a hit. Whereas the early turkey seasons are usually the prime times, it was actually the latter ones that were best in terms of success.
What's the impact exactly of weather like this on turkeys?
Well, the turkeys themselves are doing okay. It was more excuse me, impact on the turkey hunters being out, and as a result, because of weather problems, the harvest, which is right around 38,000 turkeys this year, was down about 11% from last year. So there was some impact on hunters, both because of the weather and because of delayed turkey behavior. It just took them a while to get cranked up. And there are lots of other birds, especially some of the ground-nesting spring birds like grouse, for example, that may have a tougher year this year than they did last.
And actually, you wanted to talk about grouse, and I'm just checking the Facebook page here because I think I thought that somebody had posted something about grouse. Here we go. Dave had posted. He noticed quite a few grouse when in Sawyer County last week. Lots of drumming in the woods. And he also included a picture of the muskie he caught.
That's a nice looking muskie.
And that is Dave from Augusta, who actually gave Larry a hand-carved muskie lure last year. So
nice.
Dave knows his muskie.
Well, as far as the grouse are concerned, we should be in the second or third year of the decline of the cyclic population behavior of grouse. They presumably peaked a few years ago. There's a steady decline for 5 years or so, and then they slowly rebound. So that roughly every 10 years, there are lots of grouse. So we should be on the decline side. But last year, apparently, because of that drought and the mixed effects, I mean, apples and oranges for grouse, it was a great year, apparently. It was warm and dry, and that's what the chicks really like, and they had a great hatch. And as a result, our observations during our summer field course match up with the Facebook post that there were more grouse on our study sites the students were using than we'd seen in quite a few years. And I asked our Rough Grouse Society biologist, and we'll talk about Gary a little later in the program, what he was hearing. And he said a lot of the drumming counts, which are the routine annual survey mechanism, were actually up rather than down. So bottom line, although this delayed cold wet spring may be difficult for hatch this year, there seem to be quite a few adult grouse or breeding birds from last year. So where we should have been tailing off, hey, it might be a good grouse season this fall. So there's some optimism on that front. It's nice to see the grouse around, and we did hear them drumming, and there was a tame one along the access road going into Kemp Station. I shouldn't say tame. Sometimes male birds become so aggressive that they seem tame, and this one, as you walked by on the road, would come running out of the woods and walk along with you. And we got some great pictures of him. So that was nicknamed him Buddy. And there were lots of reports of that behavior going on around the state, too, which also suggests there were perhaps more grouse than we were expecting. So that's good.
And Dave from Augusta made the comment of hearing the drumming. How are they making that drumming sound?
Well, the breeding display of the birds. The male birds find a nice log or flat surface in the woods where they have good protection in form of vegetation around them from avian predators like goshawks and the like, and they get up on this log and beat their wings. And that creates, they're not actually hitting their wings either on each other or on the log. They beat their wings so quickly that as the air rushes into this vacuum, it creates a deep thumping sound, kind of like thunder. And that deep drumming sound, thump, 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 and it accelerates as they drum, carries through the woods. And the message, of course, depends on the sex of the recipient. If you're a male grouse, it's, hey, over here on my log. You find another spot. If it's a female grouse, it's, hey, I'm over here on my log, and it's the breeding season. So
it's all context, isn't it?
Yes. So whether it's gobbling turkeys or crowing pheasants or drumming grouse or singing cardinals, it's all part of the spring bird breeding behavior.
We're talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven today. He comes by the first Wednesday of each month to share what's going on with Wisconsin wildlife and to answer your questions, hear your comments, and see your photos if you'd like to put them on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry today. And let's go to the phones and Louie in Waukesha. Hi, Louie.
Hi. I was recently up in the Presque Isle area. And I thought I noticed that the deer must have had a rough winter. Was my observation correct?
Yes. While we saw the grouse doing well up there for the last 3 weeks, the deer were just the opposite. They were pretty, for the most part, what we saw, they looked skinny. They looked kind of disheveled. I think the prolonged winter really pushed them to the extreme. Whether we lost any significant number of deer or not, based on the DNR's winter severity index, that I'm not so sure about. But we still saw good numbers of deer. They just looked like, holy cow, we're glad this winter's over because we need to find something green to eat and fatten up a little bit. So they did look pretty, hard hit.
And you were, like you said, Scott, you just spent 3 weeks up in the North Woods teaching students and doing lots of field work. What were some of the other things that you were looking for or just noticing as you were up there?
Well, the students were there for a two-week field course for wildlife ecology majors and their assignment is to work on a 40-acre parcel that student groups are assigned, and they complete over the course of the 2 weeks a pretty thorough floral and faunal survey. So they were sampling small mammals and listening for frogs and doing bird counts and just roaming around the woods in general. They did have good luck with amphibians this year, so we mentioned that earlier. Birds were coming through, the warblers and so forth were still around. That was all a little bit delayed because of the spring weather.
Again, the migration was
But that will lead into our birdathon results a little later. We did do that for a day. There was lots of bear activity. and they're still out and about and looking for food. The deer, as we mentioned, we were doing some trail camera work and had lots of pictures of deer and some close encounters, and they did look like they'd been pushed to the brink. So all in all, they had a good season. We did not, it was the first year in quite a few years, we didn't locate a fisher. But they don't seem, as we've talked about before in the program, fishers seem to have tailed off a little bit from the explosive growth they experienced in the last 30 years or so after reintroduction. What else? We encountered, they do some live trapping and sampling, and they captured lots of flying squirrels. Mm. Some years flying squirrels seem to be abundant, some years not, so that was kind of interesting. I don't believe we found a single snake, but given the cool temperatures, I'm not surprised. We did find quite a few hatchling snapping turtles, which suggests, now those are last year's turtles, so the students were bringing in these little turtles about the size of a quarter, cute little things, and thinking, wow, the turtles are already hatching. Well, those are turtles that hatched last year, but I think, again, because of the hot, dry conditions, they simply remained in the nests over winter.
Wow.
And now with all this damp weather, ground softened up, and they're digging out and heading for the lake. So that's, if people are finding small turtles, whether snappers or painted turtles or whatever, that's the aftermath of the dry conditions last year.
And when will that turtles. When will this year's hatch happen?
We did not. That was another thing that was delayed. Ordinarily, when we're up there at this time of year, the latter 2 weeks in May, there are lots of both painted turtles and snapping turtles along the gravel road digging nests in the shoulder. We didn't see a single one. So I think the turtle nesting has been delayed a bit, assuming it's happening. Of course, it's still cool up there. When I left Monday morning, I think it was 28 at our cabin. It was pretty chilly.
Wow.
Not so good for the tomatoes in the Northwoods. But anyway, assuming they get started pretty quickly, if we get back to normal summer conditions, it'll take the better part of 2 or 3 months of environmental incubation, and they should still be able to hatch out in the latter part of August, early September.
Great. We had a question on the Facebook page from Amy. She says, my husband is convinced that he saw an otter in the Black Earth Creek that runs from near Mesomany to east of Cross Plains. He was near Cross Plains when he saw it. Is that possible? If not, any ideas of what it might have been?
Well, I guess not talking to him directly. If it looked like an otter and it was the size of an otter, it was probably an otter. And it's certainly possible. There have been, you know, anywhere, maybe a half dozen animals around Dane County for years, mm-hmm. Including some that have been in Wingrick Creek here in Madison in years past and out at Token Creek Park and a variety of places. So, yes, it's quite possibly saw an otter. Now, if it looked smaller than an otter is a pretty good-sized animal. If it looked smaller but was behaving the same way, swimming and so forth, I suppose it could have been a mink. But it really depends on size, and not having the observer to speak to that, I don't know. But the short answer is, yes, it certainly could have been an otter.
Well, Amy, if you're listening and if you can get your husband to a phone, have him call us and Scott can maybe delve into the otter mystery. And let's go back to the phones in Marty in Verona. Hi, Marty.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
We had a mallard duck that chose to make a nest right against our house. And it was quite fascinating for the kids. Every day she came and laid one egg, and that went on for about 6 or 7 days. And then one morning we came out, and everything was gone. There was not a shred of eggshell or anything. And we're wondering what animal might have raided that nest and did it so neatly.
Well, the most likely culprit is a raccoon. But there are lots of possibilities. Raccoon, possum, fox. Other things will eat or depredate the eggs, but they're not quite as neat as an animal that's large enough to carry them away or cache them. So no way to know for sure, but it's a fairly depredation of ground nesting birds, especially waterfowl, is a fairly common thing, and it's a conservation issue where people are managing for waterfowl, but in a suburban setting, mallards pick some pretty strange, pretty exposed locations to nest, and sometimes they're successful with that strategy and sometimes not. This one was in the not category. Had they not been depredated, and there's probably not much you could have done about it one way or the other, you know, then it's a matter of watching through incubation and hoping to catch the hatch so you can help the ducklings get to water. But you didn't get the opportunity this time around. But she may be back next year.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Marty. And you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry and talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. Scott's happy to answer your questions and hear about your wildlife encounters when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. And our on-air producer, Dave Potraz, will be happy to get your calls and questions through us. Stay tuned. I want to thank our Milwaukee studio folks for hosting me yesterday to do the show from Milwaukee. It was great to see Kathleen Dunn and her team and other folks that are in the Milwaukee studio. So thanks for that. It was a lot of fun. Happy to be back in Madison today with Scott Craven. And tomorrow, coming up at 11, we'll talk with a psychologist about how our thoughts can influence our emotions and how we can use that in a positive way. And then at 11:45, how long do you think you could go without looking at yourself in a mirror? We'll hear from a woman who realized that obsessing about her appearance was having a negative impact on her self-esteem, so she decided to stop looking at herself for a year. It should be really interesting to hear about. Scott, think you could go for a year without looking in the mirror?
I'm trying to figure out how I could avoid that, but it's not a bad idea.
Actually, it's pretty interesting all the steps she had to go through to try to avoid mirrors because they're everywhere.
How could you avoid the rearview mirror? Well, anyway.
Tune in tomorrow.
I'll tune in tomorrow to find out.
Call in with your questions, Scott. No, it should be a really interesting show. And we have an interesting show right now with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And Scott, you alluded to the fact that the Great Wisconsin Birdathon was last month. It went the whole month of May. And that was organized by the Natural Resources Foundation, and it involved birders all over the state. You were part of one of the celebrity teams. And when you went out, what did you see? And who were you with?
Well, we did form a team that comprised of our students for the aforementioned summer field course and three of us who were involved in running the camp.
And that's a course for forest and wildlife ecology.
Correct. It's a UW course. We simply hold it at the Kemp Natural Resources Station. So we were called the Northern Highlands team, and we had an area there in northeastern Wisconsin to fan out, and we did, you know, we did everything we could within the confines of the students' normal activities, and we dispatched some teams to some pretty good areas like Powell Marsh and a few things around there to pick up birds that we knew we wouldn't get at Kemp. And we were pretty happy. Our goal was 100 species for the day, which is, if you stop to think about it, that's a lot of different kinds of birds. But we hit 94, and we were pretty happy with that. Until we saw some of the other teams reporting in, and I think the top team had 180 plus,
that's
184,
amazing.
186. But
if that's, you know, a team I'm thinking of, though, I think they did literally, I mean, it's supposed to be one day. I think they took that literally and did 24 hours.
And some of the teams had, you know, routes mapped out and covered a lot of ground. I mean, they're driving long distances to pick up a certain species. And that's fine. Dedicated birders are known for that. My congratulations go out to the folks who found that many birds. I know how hard we worked to find 94, so that's really quite amazing. But the bottom line was this was all a fundraiser to raise money to benefit various bird conservation programs in the state. And from that standpoint, it was even more successful than the species count because the original goal of $40,000 was exceeded fairly quickly, and the goal was up to 50,000, and I understand the last time I heard, they were darn close to that.
I think within a couple hundred.
Within a few bucks. So that's a lot of money for bird conservation. So everybody had a good time. So it was a big success. I suspect that will be an annual deal. There was another event scheduled there at Kemp, and I got to cook breakfast for that group before they went out, as I'm also the cook at summer camp. But in any event, everybody involved in all the different groups and activities around the state seemed to have a good time, and a lot of money was raised. So Birdathon's a cool thing.
Yeah, and hopefully it will be an annual event. Speaking of our birds, there's some very encouraging news about our eagles. The DNR is working on aerial surveys of eagle nests, and there were some really encouraging results from the April surveys.
Well, the aerial surveys are underway to count the eaglets, the young eagles in the nest, as a measure of nest success. But the April surveys you mentioned that survey occupied nesting territories suggested that we had both a record number of eagles in the state and in a record number of counties. In fact, it was darn near all the counties of the state. Even Racine County, down in the southeastern corner of the state, has nesting bald eagles now. So I think the numbers that came in, the 2012 number was just over 1,300 pairs. And this year it exceeded that by a small margin. And if you think back to the first survey, like this was done in 1973, you know, 40-some years ago, there were only 108 pairs. So we now exceed that by tenfold or more, and the distribution is virtually statewide. It's really a huge continuation of a great success story for eagles and a lot of other birds that have bounced back better than people probably expected.
It's really good to draw attention to those stories because I think so often we're really aware of the populations that are really in decline and that we're really concerned about.
I'm happy to see any good news these days. Some of the things in the news, I wish conservation information got more play in the press because generally there is a lot of good news on that front. But I'm afraid it's overshadowed by a lot of other ugly things. Anyhow.
Well, and Wisconsin recently received a couple of national awards for recreational and trail planning. And I think that really just goes to show that, you know, that appreciation and wanting to get out in and enjoy our environment and wildlife is really part of the culture here.
It's a very important part of the culture. I think the quality of life that we all enjoy here in Wisconsin is greatly enhanced by the state's commitment to natural resources through DNR efforts, through the Natural Resources Foundation, through individual efforts, all of the non-governmental organizations involved, all the bird conservation groups, all the sportsmen's groups. It's
And the collaborations. That's right. What I really find exciting is the collaborations among all those different
elements. It's truly a team effort. And if one group can't get something done, there are usually people to step up and form a friends group or do whatever it takes to get things done, whether it's helping with our national wildlife refuges or our state parks or a whole host of other things. So when you put the whole package together, Wisconsin's a pretty good place to be.
I couldn't agree more. And let's go to John in River Falls. Hi, John.
Hey, Scott. Leslie and I had the great opportunity to sample your cooking up at camp in the covert program last fall.
Well, that's going to be a great segue into something in a moment or two. So what's up, John?
Okay. Anyway, we live in River Falls Township, rural, and we have a pair of sandhill cranes that are apparently trying to nest here. I've never seen them before other than migrating over. We have a small wetland. It's only about 50 yards across with cattails and whatnot. And apparently the female's trying to nest there. And my question is, how much human activity can they take? You know, we have a riding program out here at our farm and stuff. I'm wondering if I should fence this area off or just leave them alone. Do you have any experience in that area?
Well, you know, I can't speak about that individual pair, but given some of the places cranes are turning up, I expect that the cranes are exhibiting the same behavior that a lot of other species do, and that's to show an amazing tolerance for human activity, especially when suitable nesting marshes or wetlands are in short supply. These birds will do what's necessary to occupy a territory. So I'd be tempted to say that you probably should continue with business as usual and see what happens. If the birds have picked out that territory and have become attached to it, I think they'll show pretty good tolerance. You know, not that they could stand someone trying to ride up to them to take a picture with their smartphone, but certainly with people around alerting people who are on the property that, hey, we've got a pair of cranes down there, you know, give them a wide berth if you can, or no screaming and shouting, hey, look at the cranes. I think they'll probably be okay. There's no guarantee that they will, in fact, nest. And I'm assuming that this year's crane count has taken place. I don't know. I don't remember seeing anything about the results. But there are a lot of cranes around. Cranes are doing very well, and it's not surprising to see them turning up in new places. So that's a good thing.
I think also, John, a good resource would be calling the International Crane Foundation, and they might have some good guidelines for people that have nesting cranes on their property.
Okay. I'll do that.
Great. Thanks, John. And if you get a picture of them without disturbing them, we'd love to see it up on the Facebook page. Now, you just mentioned about, Scott, how many birds have, lots of wildlife has adapted to human activity. Here's one for you. On the Facebook page, Claire says, a friend of mine has a duck in a nest about 16 feet off of the ground above her grill. Is this normal?
Well, it depends on what the duck is. Now, again, as part of our summer camp or there on the Kemp property, we had there are several species of Wisconsin ducks that normally nest in trees in cavities. So we've got mergansers, hooded merganser and common merganser, and wood ducks and golden eyes all nest in trees. And we had two nests right around the parking lot there at camp where we were working. The ducks would come and go from the holes. But mallards are so flexible that over the years here on campus, I mean, we found nests on the roof of the UW hospital. We found nests in all sorts of bizarre places, downtown and around, including the occasional tree where either a duck or a goose builds a nest, you know, 10, 15, 20 feet up in the crotch of a tree or on a flat limb or where a tree's broken off in a storm. In terms of the duck strategy, it's a pretty good one. They're up out of harm's way. Mm-hmm. In terms of is there any risk to the ducklings? No, they're little fuzz balls when they hatch, and all species, as soon as they have hatched, they're all dry, they bail out of the nest and head for water. So that a duck in the, well, we watched one of the broods emerge from a merganser nest the last time we were up there, not this year, and they were probably 30 feet up or more. And the young ones just one at a time emerged from the hole, bailed out, and dropped into the parking lot. They weren't dropping into loose leaves or whatnot in the forest. And they'd bounce a couple times and shake themselves off. And eventually they all bailed. Mom gathered them up and off they went to the lake. No harm, no foul. So no pun intended on the foul part. But in any event...
I'm not sure I believe you.
It does happen if the caller, I guess it was on the Facebook page, so we don't know what kind of a duck it was, but it could have just been a slightly misdirected mallard, or it could have been a duck that belongs in a tree.
Should she try to not use that grill that's 16 feet under the nest? If you can roll it to another part of the
duck. If you can move it to
duck.
Another spot. I don't think the I would kind of clear the way under the nest if they could so that when the ducklings do bail out, they're not landing on, you know, sharp metal or something like that. But I think the biggest issue would probably be the smoke and fumes from the grill. So move the grill for a couple of weeks and move on from there.
Well, let's go back to the phones and let's go to Rick in Richfield. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thank you both for taking my call.
Of course.
Scott, I gotta compliment you on your sense of humor with those ducks.
Well, sometimes reality is just as humorous as perception.
Oh, for sure. I've got a problem with woodchucks, groundhogs. I don't know if there are any other names for them, but...
There are several, but we can't. It's a family show. We can't use some of the other ones.
I guess so. Yes. They did some real damage in my house in Mequon. And I finally had to solve it with lead poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to do this. With this situation, I've moved out to Richfield, and I've got a mother. Last year, she had three little kits. My dog got two of them. But I don't suggest sicking your dogs on woodchucks. They've got central incisors that are pretty darn... formidable, and they can hurt your dog.
So, Rick, are you looking for a different alternative for taking care of that woodchuck problem?
I tried trapping in Mequon. All I got was rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see what Scott would suggest.
The options are fairly limited. The dog situation is not a good one for a whole host of humane reasons as well as hazard. The dog, we'll come back on that rodent bite situation in a minute. There's an interesting story about a beaver bite that we can talk about. But anyway, the shooting issue is fine in a rural area where it's legal to do so. Woodchucks, of course, I haven't heard much about it lately, but I think the proposal for a woodchuck hunting season is still on the table. But it doesn't really matter. On your own property, woodchucks have been unprotected or available for control for many years. So the shooting of a woodchuck on your own property is legal. The only thing going for that is you have immediate feedback that, aha, I got the woodchuck, and therefore, end of story. Some people don't want to do that. Some people don't have a gun. In some cases, it's illegal for safety reasons, but it's still an option for people who want to pursue that. The other option is a fumigation of the burrow system. If you know where the animal's burrows are, or they're in your rock garden or something like that, there are gas cylinders available at garden centers and hardware stores and things like that. Look like big firecrackers, and they're lit and placed in the burrow, and then that's covered, and the combustion gases penetrate the burrow and presumably dispatch the animal in the burrow. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Woodchucks have a very extensive burrow system. And then lastly, there's trapping. A well-placed live trap that allows you then to relocate the animal, if that's what you choose to do, and you've arranged a suitable release site where you have permission to do it, is probably the easiest approach. And Larry, who is not here today, I'll throw him a bone and say he's a very accomplished woodchuck trapper after removing dozens of them from his lakeshore property in Lake Monona. But the trap needs to be strategically placed. Woodchucks kind of use a regular trail to get to their feeding sites or into your garden or something like that. So if you can find a spot where they're going under a fence or moving around the corner of a building, a well-placed trap baited with fresh vegetables, greens, broccoli, green beans, apple slice, carrot slices, things like that, or a bit of a salad, so to speak, you should be able to catch them in a trap with relative ease. I think Larry had good results with apple and carrot. And then you've got the animal in the trap and can again, move them or reunite a family group or whatever you choose to do. So those are the three alternatives, and that's
all right.
It.
Good luck with that, Rick. And let's go next to Larry in Eau Claire. Hi, Larry.
Hi. My question is regard to snapping turtles near Somerset, Wisconsin, on the Apple River. And I hope, Scott, that you might be familiar with that area. I don't know if you are or not. Anyway, I was staying up there for several days to take care of some pets just out of Somerset up along the Apple River. There's a dam up there. And to protect the top of the dam, they did an unusual thing. They took pairs of old light poles and somehow cabled them together end to end and stretched them out at an angle from the shoreline to the far side of the dam to keep flotsam, I suppose, from going over. Well, anyway, I came back from Somerset one morning and the sun was out, and here were hundreds and hundreds of snapping turtles lining this double log protection thing, and a few painted turtles. But these were large, appeared to be snapping turtles. The next day, at some point it got cloudy and they disappeared. The next day I came through when it happened to be sunny, and there they were again. Questions are, one, is this a known event in this area? And I just can't imagine that many snapping turtles in a small, relatively small body of water. This would be the lake behind the dam. And number two, from my vantage point up on the road, I was looking at them. I didn't have binoculars, but they appeared to have kind of smooth shells. Well, I'm familiar with snapping turtles. Been close to them many times.
They weren't snapping turtles. That's the problem. I guess if I understand correctly, so there was essentially a log boom created, away from shore to protect things like errant fishing boats or whatnot from getting up on the dam. And what they created with those logs was a perfect basking site for turtles. And in a, you know, in a good flowage where there are lots of fish and food and so forth and maybe not so many basking sites, it can give the appearance of a lot more turtles than most people would think were there. So you know your turtles, but the and you recognize the painted turtles. Those would be the most common ones. But snapping turtles virtually never bask.
Hmm.
In fact, I've never seen one basking on, you know, the way we would see painted turtles. So the other possibilities, I'm trying to think. I don't know the Somerset or Apple River area. But if they had smooth shells, that sounds like the possibility of a population of what would probably be spiny soft shells. But there are a couple of other species that might be in there using the flowage as well. But the only thing I can tell you for sure is that it would be very, very strange if, in fact, they were snapping turtles. And once you said smooth shells, then especially as snapping turtles get bigger, they get, at least the medium-sized ones are pretty rough and jagged-looking with those keels, basically, on the back of their shells. So I think we're actually looking at another species, and I can't tell you for sure without a picture or a better description, but I am pretty safe or pretty confident in saying that there were some painted turtles there and something else, but not snapping turtles.
Yeah, that's interesting then, because these were definitely the size of large snapping turtles.
Yeah, the only turtle that gets that big in a river system is again. So what county are we talking about, Larry?
Pierce?
So up in the northwest. So we're outside the range, I think, of most of the map turtles, unless that connects with, you know, those can get pretty large. And we're also out of the range, I think, of smooth soft shells. So my guess is spiny soft shells.
Hmm.
They look kind of flat?
No, they didn't look flat at all. They looked just like snapping turtles with the same rounded, and their heads, as they sat there sunning, their heads were up in the air with large heads like snapping turtles. Everything looked like snapping turtles except the smoothness of the shells. The gray, they were gray, but smoother.
Did you see any color? Any color on the head or neck that you could discern?
No, I couldn't see any color on the head at all.
Okay, another one that has a smooth, rather high shell is Blanding's turtle, but they have a very distinctive bright yellow throat, which I think would have been visible had one, even just one of them, been turned toward you. Mm. And, you know, beyond that, there aren't that many possibilities. I'm just not sure without my range maps here whether we're out of the territory of a couple of the map turtles as you get over toward the Mississippi. That's a possibility, too, but I just don't think they were snappers.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Larry. And if you can get a picture of those turtles, definitely send it in to us, and we can have Scott or even one of the amphibian and reptile people at the DNR take a look at it. We are talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven about all the wonderful wildlife we enjoy here in Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. And Scott, you said you wanted to tell a rodent bite story.
Well, this is also related to the recent time in the North Woods. While we spend a lot of time working, we do occasionally get out after supper for a little fishing. And on one particular evening, we were in a small bog pond adjacent to the lake, and there were quite a few beaver lodges on the edge of the pond, and therefore quite a few beavers, including one especially large individual. In any event, we were minding our own business, floating along, casting a bobber, fishing for crappies, and as my companion, an unnamed forester, lobbed a cast, the largest beaver surfaced, and plop, the bobber, slip bobber, landed on the back of the beaver. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's going to foul hook the thing. We're going to be in for a tough time of it here. Well, the beaver made for shore with the bobber on his back. Just as it got close to shore, my fishing partner kind of gave it a little tug, and the bobber popped right off. landed in the water in a prime spot. Boom, he had a fish. And that since became known as the beaver technique.
There you go.
But in any event, the next morning, however, in scanning the news, one of our colleagues on his smartphone picked up a news release from Russia that a fisherman had been killed by a beaver. And we thought that was an incredibly fortuitous coincidence to harass the forester. But nevertheless, the point was that fisherman had been trying to grab the beaver for a photographic opportunity, got bitten, the bite severed an artery, and he bled to death, which is an unfortunate tragedy. But it brings up the caller's earlier concern about messing with woodchucks, whether it's you or your dog or anything else. When you get to a big rodent from a woodchuck on up to a beaver, or even a porcupine for that matter, although there are other problems with porcupines, those incisor teeth are incredibly powerful. You don't mess with a big rodent in a live trap or in the wild or any other way. So,
And just because animals are near us doesn't mean that they shouldn't be treated with respect and kept at a distance.
Right, and I don't recommend the beaver technique for bobber deployment.
It would probably be hard to yes. really make sure that that was what you were doing. Well, let's go next to Don in Woodruff, who has a question. Hi, Don.
Hi. We had a doe grazing in our backyard this morning. It went over behind the house in a bed of daffodils, and out came a very tiny fawn with it. The fawn was so small that it could barely nurse, but it did nurse in the backyard, and the doe would keep licking the fawn, and was sort of wondering how old would a fawn be that would be about that size. Scott knows the lawn I'm talking about.
I know the lawn very well. It was I was positioned there during the birdathon watching Don's bird feeder for a bit of time. I'm guessing that fawn was probably just dropped on within the last few days, around June 1st, give or take, and depending on where you are in the state, is kind of the peak of fawn drop. There are fawns all over the place at this point, despite the cool weather, so it was probably only a couple of days old, if that.
Wow.
It could walk okay? Was it still shaky?
It was walking, but as I say, it sort of hobbled around, and it was trying to nursing, and it could just barely reach its head high enough to nurse, and I just have never seen a fawn that small before.
Well, it's a pretty neat thing to have happen in your backyard. It may have been born right there, for that matter, and you've got a good backyard for that. Hopefully it'll hang out there and avoid becoming bear food or something else that might befall it in that area. So good luck with that. Get some pictures of it.
Thanks,
if you haven't already.
Yeah, we'd love to see those. And Tim in Kadat has a question that's also related to fawns. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi.
I was at my cabin, and about 100 feet from the cabin, I found a fawn. And I had gone up there on Sunday to cut firewood for a few days. I took its picture, but I stayed away from the area then. But I watched it, and I never did see the mother come back all during the days. And I was wondering how often the mothers feed them? And with this cold weather, did I be in there? Did I doom the little guy, or are they more?
No, they're a little tougher than we'd probably give them credit for, and the fawns don't the does don't visit them very often by design. The fawn relies on its spotted coloration to protect it with that pattern of camouflage and a general lack of scent, so that a passing bear, coyote, or other potential predator doesn't find them. Although they still do find quite a few of them, but. I think that it's a trade-off for a doe. Being somewhere like Don's backyard or near your cabin means that there's probably less probability that a bear or coyote's going to meander by that close to the house or cabin or on the edge of town. But it also means there's more disturbance, and I think the doe probably accommodates that and was visiting at times or feeding the fawn at times when there was no activity or you were soundly asleep. So, bottom line is, you didn't do anything incorrect or damaging or anything that you you wouldn't normally do. So, I suspect the fawn's probably fine, and you'll see it again later.
Well, good. I was kind of worried with lack of food and this cold, wet weather that we're having.
Well, I mean, the cold, wet weather is a bit of a problem, as we talked about a little earlier, for a lot of different things. But it's for these animals, they're forced to play the hand they're dealt, so to speak. So if it's hot and dry, it's one thing. If it's cold and damp, it's something else. And it may be really good for some species and really bad for others. But there's really little or nothing we can do to intervene.
All right. Thanks for that call, Tim. And let's go right back to the phones and Terry in Milford. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I've got a bird that I cannot identify. It appears to like a species of a robin, but it's bigger than a robin, and it looks like a crow. It nests in a cavity. The starlings and stuff are flying in and out of the cavities of some awnings or eaves that are hanging down. And these birds go also in there, but they don't ever come to the ground.
So the bird's the size of a crow.
No, but it's about the size of a pigeon.
About the size of
like a crow.
A pigeon-sized crow-looking bird.
But it's not a starling. It's bigger than a starling. It's not a grackle.
Right. Nope, it's not a grackle.
They're solid black. They're solid black?
It's solid. It's solid dark.
Solid dark.
All I get out of it is a silhouette. Well, it's black or dark brown. All I can get out of it with the binoculars is a silhouette. It always manages, a pair of them, to just hang in the loosely leafed trees, and I can't get a color at it.
Have you seen the beak or any of the tail or anything else that might give us a clue?
The tail is kind of fanned like a robin's. You know, I mean, it's long.
Yeah.
And the beak is pointy. It's not yellow. It's black. It's dark.
Hmm. What do you think, Scott?
Hmm. Well, I think, Terry, you need to do some further observation. I mean, since you know where the nest is, I mean, keep an eye out. See if you can get a picture, or see if you can get any further information. See if you can get a look when the light is better, or borrow a trail camera from a friend and set that up so that you're going to get pictures. You seem to know where they are in the trees and where the nest cavity is. See what you can get. It's not any kind of a woodpecker that you can think of.
No.
You know, as you, I'm just kind of running through the cavity nesters in my mind. It's not any of the ducks we mentioned earlier, which would be bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, Terry, try to get a photo if you can, and also maybe more on the behavior. And
you mentioned it is pigeon-sized and dark. You don't think it's a pigeon, do you?
No, there's pigeons on the silo. I know the difference.
Okay, all right, so that's good. So we've knocked that out. It's the size and the dark color I'm drawing a blank. Well, anyway, see what you can come up with, Terry. If you get any further information, send it into public radio here. We'll have a look.
All right, thanks for that, Terry. And as we're coming up on the news here, just to point out on the Facebook page, Anthony posted a nice picture of Sandhill Cranes. It says, saw these three cranes yesterday while riding the Glacial Drumlin Trail about a half mile east of Highway 67, just south of Highway 18 in Waukesha County. Two adults and a youngster, and there's one parent leading the way and one parent bringing up the rear and the little guy in the middle. It's a nice picture. Thanks for that, Anthony. And then also on the bird topic, Julie says, bobolinks. I spend several hours every day riding my bike through southwest Wisconsin, and I'm lucky if I see three bobolinks a year. The other day, the farmers were mowing fields where I have seen bobolinks, and as expected, the bobolinks were flying out as the field was being mowed. I understand the farmers must make hay while the sun shines and that the bobolink nests were destroyed. Are there still programs in place for protecting bobolinks, and what's the population looking like?
Well, in short, yes, there are many programs, including the Conservation Reserve Program, to keep permanent grass cover on the landscape. And there are other landscape-scale conservation projects as well in southwestern Wisconsin and east-central Wisconsin to benefit grassland birds like bobolinks. But they and many other grassland birds are not common anymore, and agricultural practices have been one of the culprits. But as she says, we need agricultural production, so it's a trade-off, but there are programs out there to help them.
And a caller suggested that the turtle that the earlier listener was asking about was maybe a leatherback.
Well, that's the soft shell that I was talking about.
Okay, there you go. And let's see, we have just about a minute before the news. And there's a photo of a frog on the Facebook page. Gerald says this frog was sunning himself about 2 weeks ago and was wondering what kind it is.
It's a gray tree frog.
Gray tree frog?
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's a nice picture. It looks very comfortable there sunning himself. And another caller just called in to help out and suggested that maybe a brown-headed cowbird was what Jerry, I think, was seeing in and out of that hole.
Could be, although they're not even as big as a robin, and certainly not pigeon size, but we'll see. Usually we turn to the listeners, and we may get some other leads, but I think we need some more information from Terry.
Yes, and hopefully he'll be able to get some photos and send those in. You can join the conversation. We'll be coming back with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven after the news. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post a question, comment, or we love those photos on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show. And Mehler is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mehler. And each year that I live in Wisconsin, I develop a deeper and deeper appreciation for our wildlife. And getting to listen to Scott Craven explain their behaviors and give tips on what to watch for has certainly made me much more observant. Scott comes by once a month to talk about the cycles of nature in Wisconsin, and we're always happy to have him on. Scott, thanks as always for spending time with us.
I enjoy every minute of it.
And this summer is 25 years in Wisconsin for me.
Wow. Let's see. August will be 41 years in Wisconsin for me.
Well, as always, you're ahead of me on that. But we have people on the phone. We have lots of great emails and Facebook comments from people. But I want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about the Coverts program, which was mentioned earlier, but I want to go into that a little more.
Yes, actually, the deadline for applications is coming up pretty quickly here. I think it's the 15th of June. The Coverts Workshop is our landowner private woodland management program, 3-day workshop that we've been offering for years, coordinated by my colleague Jamie Knack. And we do ask for applications because each group is limited to 25 or 30 landowners, which is our capacity up at Kemp Station. But landowners come in on a Thursday night and then go through a series of field tours, workshops, lectures, fireside discussions, informal discussions for 3 days, all designed to empower them to be both better stewards of their own wooded land, but also to reach out to their neighbors, friends, the community, or whatever, to spread the word about good forest stewardship, primarily related to wildlife habitat and good forestry. It is a great program. The landowners love it. We love it. It's just worked out very nicely. There's no cost to the participants other than getting there. It's all underwritten by a couple of grants. And if anybody's interested in finding out more about it this time around, I think it's the last weekend in August. I don't have the brochure with me, but I want to say it's like that Thursday. If Thursday is in the 25th of August, then that's when it starts, runs through the next Sunday morning. And you could get an application by emailing Jamie Knack at jlknack, N-A-C-K, at wisc.edu, and you've only got a few days to do that. But it's a great program, and it's supported by a number of organizations, but most particularly long support from the Ruffed Grouse Society and regional biologist Gary Zimmer. And I just wanted to get a plug in, a bit of congratulations to Gary. He was just appointed recently by the governor to the Natural Resources Board. And a lot of us were just thrilled that a person who's as skilled a biologist and as dedicated a conservationist as Gary is, that we are really happy to see him on the NRB. So that's great, and congratulations, Gary, on that appointment.
Great. And again, it's the Coverts program, and people can get information by emailing Jamie Knack at jlknack, N-A-C-K, at wisc.edu.
Yes.
Great. And here's a homeowner question. Tom emailed, 10 years ago, we allowed a 7-acre hayfield to return to wetlands. Muskrat lodges went way up in this past fall. Should we intervene?
Well, I'm not sure what Tom means by intervention, but first of all, it's a great example of what happens when you restore habitat. So a hayfield was converted to wetlands, and muskrats do what muskrats do. They responded to wetland habitat. Now there's a lot of muskrats. So unless they're causing some sort of a problem to water control structure that keeps it a wetland or adjoining crops or something like that, there's really no reason to intervene. On the other hand, if there's a superabundance of muskrats, they are a valuable fur bearer and very abundant, so there'd be no particular harm if it's within Tom's interest to invite a local trapper in to harvest some of said muskrats and make a few bucks and keep the population in check, or Tom could do that himself. But beyond that, I don't know what the intervention might take the form of. So,
all right,
no
but
problem.
It sounds like if it's not causing problems, no compelling reason to really
do
anything.
No, I mean, just like many of the animals that we see in our backyards, I mean, most animals or many animals have the capacity to cause problems for landscape plants, vegetable gardens, spring flowers, a whole host of other things. But if they're not doing that, and if you've figured out some way to prevent them from doing it, then, hey, enjoy the animals for what they are to see and enjoy in the property.
Great. Let's go to Earl in Wyawega next. Hi, Earl.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to compliment you on your show. I just, I really look forward to the times when Scott's on, and it's always very interesting.
Oh.
My question is, I have we have a cabin up near Florence, and usually about the middle of May, we get these delightful birds, and I believe that they are hermit thrushes, and they have just this beautiful song. Sounds like a flute to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, we only have heard one all spring, and I'm wondering if their return has been delayed or if something bad has happened to the species, or if he has any idea about that.
Well, first of all, Earl, thanks for the kind words about the program. That's really nice to
hear. Yes, I second that. Thanks, Earl.
Second issue, there are a number of northern forest thrushes, but the one that I think has let me ask you another question if you're still on there. What time of day did you hear them? Toward evening, late in the day, often?
Yes, you can hear them usually throughout the day, but usually right in the evening, just right at dusk.
Well,
and it's just a haunting.
Yes, they have a beautiful song, and I actually think that's more likely to be a wood thrush. During this the session we're talking about or have talked about a little bit on the program regarding our summer field course the last couple of weeks, there were lots of hermit thrushes singing, but it's not as beautiful a song as the wood thrush, and that's the one that tends to sing, you know, just as dusk is falling, and on a calm night it's really very pretty. So that's what I'm thinking you're hearing, but I'm sure you probably have both. And either way, any delay you've seen is probably more related to the spring conditions than any kind of disaster amongst those two birds.
Good.
Be patient. Maybe, they'll show up.
Maybe when we get up there again, I look forward to it almost as much as having loons come back in the spring.
Well, check out. There are lots of sites you can go to on the internet, Wisconsin's eBird site or the Cornell Lab of Ornithology or just bird field guides, and you can actually call up essentially on the computer the calls of some of these things and listen to the hermit thrush and the wood thrush and see for sure which one you're enjoying.
I have actually done that.
Okay.
And that's the reason I came up with the hermit thrush.
Hmm.
Because it sounded more like it. And then, as luck would have it, the next time I went up, I actually saw a pair.
Okay.
They were hermit thrushes. So,
well, all of them sing very well, but maybe I'm biased. My personal favorite is the wood thrush. But
My wife would tell you I don't hear that good anyway.
Okay.
or is it that she says you don't listen very well?
Well...
That too. Okay. Well, thanks so much for that, Earl. It sounds like a wonderful call.
It's a very pretty call.
Let's go to Dusty in Appleton next. Hi, Dusty.
Hi. Yeah, I got a question. My wife had me put in some flowers here recently, and we've been noticing they've been getting chewed down, and I'm assuming it's a rabbit issue I'm dealing with, and I'm trying to figure out what I can do. It's not an area where we necessarily want to fence it in or mm-hmm. anything. Is there a certain product or thing I can do to keep those rabbits away from those flowers?
And I'll add in, can we keep them away from my sugar snap peas because they've completely mowed them down?
Well, it's not easy. Rabbits are, of course, very abundant, and they are notorious vegetation consumers, whether it's snap peas or various flowers. If it's a matter of kind of getting the flowers through the vulnerable period, they've been growing so darn slowly because of the weather, they should be bigger than they are now. But if it's a matter of the vulnerable period, even a temporary fence around a flower bed will put an end to the rabbit problem. It doesn't have to be very high, foot and a half at best, but it does have to be tight to the soil. And whether it's hardware cloth, welded wire, small mesh chicken wire, whatever, that will solve the problem. Now, it's not very aesthetically pleasing to look at, but once the flowers get well established, the rabbits can usually do a little pruning, and you won't notice it as much as losing the seedlings. That's one alternative. There are a few things they don't like. Naphthalene flakes, for example, are one. Those could be sprinkled in the flower bed. When I felt I absolutely positively had to protect some seedling cabbages and peas a few weeks ago, I was using a blood meal product called Plant Skid, S-K-Y-L-L-D. It's a Swedish product, and it's essentially blood meal, but it can be formulated into a spray, and I've had pretty good luck with that. There are other commercial repellents as well. So those are the two biggest alternatives, and then, of course, the third one is get yourself a have a heart or a tomahawk live trap or any other good live trap, and bait that with some attractive stuff like sliced apple or carrots or greens and attempt to remove the offending rabbit if it's caught in the act. Those are your options.
Well, and Scott, I've also heard things like that rabbits don't like marigolds or that you can use human hair or things like that. Any truth to any of those?
There's only validity when it works, and whether it was truly cause and effect or not is difficult to prove. But among the litany of things, human hair, bars of soap, those will, of course, be picked up quickly by the neighborhood dogs or other things that are attracted to soap. Various commercial repellents, like the Plant Skid that I mentioned. But while repellents may have some utility, they generally don't work for a long period because rain takes them out and you have to keep applying them or you miss a day and, oh, wow, the rabbits knock everything back and then you're frustrated. So I really rely in my own situation with either fencing or removal of the rabbits, and there are several ways to remove rabbits.
All right. We'll leave it. That. Mm-hmm. But on another note, if people go to our Facebook page, that's the Larry Mueller Show. We've had some listeners post some really lovely photos of fawns, twin fawns born on May 28th in Arborvitae. Ron posted really lovely picture of two little fawns and the doe with them. And then Michael posted a really wonderful picture of that, as you said, the fawn. Mm-hmm. Using its spots to camouflage itself. They came across this little fawn while out on a walk last Wednesday.
Well, they're very photogenic. There's no question about that. And those are both very nice photos.
So thanks for sharing those. And you can share photos on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. And we also had some calls about nests and duck boxes. One caller asked for tips on when to remove an assumed unused bird's nest, for example, tucked under a drain spout. Is it safe to remove and will the birds come back?
Well, I guess it depends a little bit on nest, but if there's a nest, for example, an old robin's nest on your light fixture by the front door or whatever else, or a house finch nest, then you should certainly remove that as long as there aren't eggs in it. Some people are removing. We did battle with swallows nesting, making mud nests on the front porch for a long time. And as long as you can either prevent them from building, or once the nest has been used for the year and the fledglings have taken off, then remove that, clean up the area, and do what you can to prevent them from coming back. Some birds are very faithful to a particular spot on the house. Some birds won't come back at all, either because they've simply survival is not that great. So, you know, clean up after the nesting season and be done with it.
And I'm not sure, actually, if the caller was hoping they would come back or hoping they would not come back.
Hard to tell. Hard to tell from that comment.
And let's go back to the phones and Holly in Brookfield. Hi, Holly.
Hi. I had a question because right against my front brick wall of my house, a mallard duck has laid a nest of 10 eggs, and we keep scaring her off, and she keeps coming back. How long will they survive with her off the nest? And if they haven't, would she still be sitting on them? And then my third question is, what's my chances of actually seeing the ducklings if they have?
So are you trying to scare her off or accidentally scaring her off?
It's accidentally.
Oh, okay. I thought you were trying to drive her off the nest.
No, and then friends will come and we're trying to get everybody to go through a different door. But we scare her off and then sometimes it seems like she's off maybe even overnight and she keeps coming back.
Hmm. As long as she's maintaining incubation, you know, they may hatch, they may not. You won't know until the incubation period's over with. I don't know the exact physical layout of the door from the nest or whatnot, but you could, you know, you could get a piece of camouflage burlap or some things that hunters use for blind, for example, and with a couple of simple little fiberglass posts, put that up as a bit of a barrier on the side of the nest, or not necessarily right up against the nest, but between where the human traffic is and the duck, and maybe minimize the disturbance if you want to. From the time she started incubating, when the clutch was complete at 10, you know, you're looking at about 3 weeks to see what happens. The likelihood of catching the hatch, for some reason they seem, I don't know how the timing works out that way, but they often seem to emerge early in the morning. As you said, they'll hatch, they'll dry off, and boom, they're gone, headed for water. It doesn't take very long. So it's a pretty narrow window that you have to catch. But if you can kind of backdate to when you think she started persistently sitting on the nest or sitting on the 10 eggs and then move forward, just be vigilant and check it periodically. You might get lucky. Or
okay.
Best thing you'll find is a hatched nest with a bunch of eggshells and the ducklings are gone.
So she won't be on them unless they're alive yet.
Well, the duck has no way of knowing that. So if by any chance she was driven off during an especially cold morning and they just get chilled at the point that the embryos died, she'll sit on them past the point of normal hatch. It depends on the hen how far, and then eventually throw in the towel and leave. But she'll probably re-nest somewhere else and may still get a brood of ducklings.
Do you know about how long ago she started sitting on the nest?
It's been 2.5 weeks since we had 10. They were like one egg, and then a few days later, two,
yeah,
and then five.
It should be within the next week that something happens if it's going to.
Okay, very exciting. Thank you for
okay.
Thanks, Holly. Good luck with that. And we do have time for maybe one more call if you want to join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Karen emailed, we have a wood duck incubating in our PVC duck house above our pier. There's been a red-tailed hawk sitting on the roof. Will the hawk try to get into the house when the hen is out?
Well, the hawk probably can't get into the house when the hen is out, but I'd be tempted to put a guard on top of the house. In other words, you can make a cone out of either sheet plastic or sheet metal, and essentially, I mean, it looks like a clown hat, and sit that on top of the house. It won't bother the duck at all. They're going in at the hole level, but the hawk won't be able to perch on the roof, and that may facilitate things all the way around.
Might give the ducks a little more of a chance. Mary in Rice Lake emails, I put up a new wood duck box this year and have a nesting pair. After the first clutch is hatched, will they have another, or will other wood ducks use the box?
They may have a second brood. It depends on if they're successful, then they'll usually go about taking care of that brood and go off about their business. It's possible that another separate hen that perhaps lost a clutch or whatnot might occupy the house, but chances are that house is probably done for the year.
And a caller had a pair of what looked like pure white herons. Is that a variation or an example of albino birds?
Well, they're probably egrets.
That's what I, yeah, so, that's what I was thinking. And also, Ben emailed, and he suggests using an electric fence to get rid of problem woodchucks away from buildings or gardens. That way you don't have to kill or relocate them. Just place the electric fence wires a few inches off the ground, and you'll be rid of your problem animals.
That's certainly possible. There are lots of electric fence configurations that can be set to deal with raccoons, woodchucks, on up to the size of deer, but... you have to be a little careful with electric fencing, both for your own safety, and if there are kids or pets around or whatever else, then you need to be a little careful.
Be a little careful.
That's definitely a snapping turtle.
Yeah, Scott's looking at a photo up on the Facebook page that Mary posted. She said, I wanted to post a picture of the snapper that we found under a boxwood in northwest Waukesha County. We relocated him to the river nearby for hopes of a long life, and that's a great picture of a snapping turtle.
It is. I hope that wasn't a female just diligently trying to use that as a nest site and then find herself, man, I walked all the way up here to lay my eggs and now I'm back in the lake again. But oh well.
We won't have time to talk about it now, but June is Invasive Species Month and we'll be talking about that at length next Wednesday. But Scott, what you mentioned a relatively new invasive that you're kind of battling.
Yeah, I've had a variety of problems over the years, from box elder and black locust and Canada thistle and some parsnip, some of the more common ones. But now I have one called Japanese hedge parsley, which is a relatively new invader here in Dane County. And it's as I drove around on the tractor last night mowing my fire breaks from a plant here, plant there, which I tried to deal with. Now it's all over the place. And dealing with invasive plants is a necessary and very frustrating thing. It's really a challenge. There are a lot of problematic plants out there, and people are often unaware of what they are.
And I think often when we think of invasive species, we do think of those plants because there has been a lot of really good outreach and education, but there are also quite a few invasive animals as well.
There are invasives in every taxa, from fish to mammals and so forth. I mean, you think back, Norway rats and house mice are kind of one of our original invasive species, and then sparrows and starlings and on up the line. So, and carp and Asian carp, jumping carp, whatever the silver carp, whatever those are called in the Illinois River, it's a real challenge for managers to try and keep those species out of natural environments.
And so, again, next week at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking with folks from the DNR about Invasive Species Month. Scott, why don't you, again, give people the information for finding out about the Covert's landowner.
Yeah, workshop's coming up the end of August, 3-day session, well, 4 days actually, Thursday to Sunday morning, if people are interested in that. But first of all, you need to be a woodland owner. We favor folks with good-sized tracts of wooded land, and then landowners who are motivated and willing to reach out to other people, so gregarious people-type people. And if you think you might qualify or are interested, you can get an application from Jamie Knack. The email is jlnack@wisc.edu.
And of course, the big question is, will you be cooking them breakfast?
All the meals, actually.
Well, there you go. If you needed any more incentive, you'll get to sample Scott's cooking, which I have not, just for the record. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, comes by the first Wednesday of every month. Thanks for joining us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned to the Ideas Network.